Welcome to the course in the Gospel of Matthew. This is David Turner, and this is Lecture 1A, the first lecture of the tape set on this Gospel. As you work on all the tapes, you'll want to have as a companion to the lecture the supplemental materials which you should have received from the seminary. The lectures has in the supplemental materials an outline which explains where the lecture is going, and most of them have some supplemental additional materials which will help you follow and hopefully be an aid to your own study of this wonderful book. So this is Lecture 1A. We're dealing with some introductory matters, not the most exciting material, but still helpful to understand the setting of the Gospel of Matthew. So please follow along. On page 3, take notes on that sheet if you so desire. The origins of the Gospel of Matthew. The origins of the Gospel of Matthew are not easily ascertained. Matthew is anonymous, as are the other three Gospels. One could only make educated guesses about the author, the recipients, and the setting of this Gospel. Such guesses amount to hypotheses which are formed by noting the book's grammar, syntax, literary style, and by studying its distinctive themes. By reading between the lines, so to speak, by noting patristic traditions, that is, traditions from the early church fathers, and such avenues of study. These traditions unanimously affirm that the Gospel of Matthew was the first gospel, which runs counter to modern thinking in this respect, and that the Gospel of Matthew was written by the Apostle Matthew. Well, let's think about the authorship for a moment. Though the Gospel of Matthew is anonymous, it seems clear that it was indeed ascribed to Matthew the Apostle by the first quarter of the second century of the Common Era. When I use the term Common Era, I use that to be the same as what most people mean when they say A.D. or Anno Domini, a year of our Lord. Common Era is a term which just means the time which began with Jesus when Jews and Christians lived in common era. So the Gospel of Matthew was ascribed to Matthew the Apostle as the author by the first quarter of the second century of the Common Era. Notable ancient manuscripts have titles which ascribe the book to the Apostle Matthew. Patristic traditions agree with this ascription in such places as Eusebius' Ecclesiastical History, who in 3.39 cites Papias from the early second century. Clement of Alexandria is cited by Eusebius in 614. Clement was from the early 3rd century. Origen, cited by Eusebius in his Ecclesiastical History 6.25.4, Origen from the mid-3rd century. All of these individuals, Papias, Clement of Alexandria, and Origen, affirm that the Apostle Matthew is the author of the first Gospel. The words of Irenaeus from the late 2nd century of the Common Era agree with Eusebius. Additional 4th century testimony to this effect can be found in Cyril of Jerusalem, Epiphanius, and Jerome. The remarkable fact that this patristic tradition posits that Matthew was originally written in Hebrew will be discussed later under canonicity and textual history. The patristic testimony aside, most scholars are led by the Jewish orientation of Matthew to conclude that its author was a Jewish Christian. Perhaps Christian-Jew is a more historically accurate term. But there is a minority view which asserts that Matthew's Jewish trappings are the literary creation of a Gentile author's polemics against Judaism. I think that's a mistaken view, but there are those who hold it. Now as to the date of the book, it is very likely that there are allusions to Matthew in the church father Ignatius, who lived in the late 1st and early 2nd century of the Common Era. Also in a document called the Didache, a patristic document from the early 2nd century of the Common Era. These early allusions, taken in conjunction with the Papias testimony, which we mentioned a moment ago, make it clear that Matthew was well known by the early 2nd century. Accordingly, the Gospel must have been written by the turn of the first century at the very latest. The current scholarly consensus, based on the mark and priority view of Gospel relationships, places Matthew's origin in the 80s or 90s of the Common Era. In some cases, this view is buttressed by the idea that Matthew 24:25 constitutes a prophecy after the event about the destruction of Jerusalem. written after the destruction of Jerusalem in Common Era 70. That's a mistake, I believe, to think that that is a prophecy after the event put on the lips of Jesus. But there are those who argue that way. Additionally, it's sometimes argued that the historical situation reflected in Matthew is a conflict of the developing church with the formative rabbinic Judaism, which emanated from Jamnia after the destruction of Jerusalem. On the other hand, if one accepts the patristic testimony to apostolic authorship, the date will probably need to be set earlier. Additionally, if one takes Matthew 24:25, as I do, as an authentic tradition from Jesus, not as a prophecy after the event, there is no need to date the gospel after 70. Therefore, if one is not convinced that Matthew is dependent upon Mark, and I'm not, there is another reason for an early date. There are noteworthy scholars who favor a pre-70 date for Matthew, and these would include such scholars as Craig Blomberg, Don Carson, Robert Gundry, Gerhard Meyer, Bo Ryka, and J.A.T. Robinson. But all in all, scholars are not dogmatic about the date of the book. Now, the recipients and occasion of Matthew. Matthew's characteristic fulfillment formula, quotations from the Hebrew Bible, and his presentation of a Jesus who came not to destroy but to fulfill the law and the prophets are but two of the reasons why every student of Matthew must come to some conclusion about the relationship of this gospel's recipients to Judaism. Scholars are divided on this issue, with some convinced that Matthew's community contains many Gentiles and is already separated from the synagogue. Gundry and Stanton come to this conclusion. Others hold the opposite view, that Matthew's community is largely Jewish and is still connected with the synagogue, folks like Harrington, Overman, Salderini, Segal, and Sim. And there are those who occupy a sort of middle ground between these two opposites, arguing that Matthew can be satisfactorily explained only when it is viewed against the background of an embattled minority, that is, Matthew's people, in the process of leaving the synagogue, that is, those whom Jesus is attacking. Hagner is one who takes that view. In this course, the view that Matthew's community is still engaged with the synagogue has been adopted. And such scholars as Overman, Salderini, and Sim have argued, to my mind, conclusively to this effect. And the commentary which probably takes this most clearly and consistently is the massive three-volume work by W.D. Davies and Dale Allison in the International Critical Commentary series. That book is indispensable for anyone who wishes to really study Matthew in depth. While many theories have been proposed, the location of Matthew's community will likely never be known with anything approaching certainty. The city of Antioch has many advocates, but others suggest Tyre or Sidon, Kilpatrick, Galilee, Overman, or even Pella in the Transjordan. A fellow named Slingerland came to that conclusion. It's a happy fact that grasping the message of this book does not depend on knowing the location of its original recipients. The occasion of the Gospel's writing and its purpose are, of course, not explicitly stated anywhere in it, and can only be approximated by hypotheses inferred from Matthew. Assuming that the audience is a Christian Jewish community, as I do, it is evidently a community which needs to understand how the life of Jesus the Messiah fulfilled the Hebrew Bible, and how Jesus' teaching interpreted the Torah of Moses, chapter 5, verse 17 and following. This community also needed to know why the entrenched non-Christian Jewish leaders were no longer to be followed, chapter 23. The community also evidently needed to expand its horizons toward Gentile mission. Matthew regularly portrays Gentiles in a positive light, as when the Gentile women are mentioned in Jesus' genealogy, chapter 1, verses 3, 5, and 6, and the faith of certain Gentiles is stressed, check chapter 8, verse 10, 15, 28, and 27, 54. Such details from the narrative prepare the reader for the climactic commission that the community take Jesus' message to all the nations in 28:19. The following discussion of Matthew's theological emphasis provides additional implications about the occasion and purpose of the gospel. Now we move on to the matter of canonicity and textual history, our second main issue here on Lecture 1A. First, we need to consider the testimony of Papias. A foundational question in the textual history of Matthew is its possible origin as a Semitic text which was only later translated into our present Greek Matthew. Patristic sources which take this position have been cited in the previous discussion of authorship. The key patristic text is Eusebius Ecclesiastical History 33.39.16, which cites Papias to the effect that Matthew collected the oracles about Jesus in the Hebrew language, and each one interpreted them as best he could. At first glance, Eusebius' citation of Papias seems to say that Matthew had originally composed in Hebrew, and that later people perhaps translated from that Hebrew original into our Greek gospel. Since our present Greek Matthew does not read like a translation of a Hebrew original, some have argued that Matthew wrote both a Hebrew gospel and a Greek gospel. Others think that Papias's oracles, or logia, were sayings of Jesus which modern source critics call Q, or even the discourses of Jesus which are found in our Greek Matthew. But there seems to be no manuscripts which exemplify this so-called the Hebrew Matthew mentioned by Papias. For these and other reasons, others, such as Gundry, propose that the term Hebrew dialect actually does not mean the Hebrew language, but a Semitic style of writing or a rhetorical style. And that when Papias says that each one interpreted, that does not mean translation, but each one interpreted those as he saw fit. If this is the case, Papias says that Matthew's style of composition was Jewish, and that subsequent individuals interpreted this Jewish style of writing to the best of his ability. Perhaps such features as Matthew's genealogy and his stress on fulfillment are indicative of his Jewish compositional style. As far as Greek manuscripts go, the textual history of Matthew is exemplified in a great number of them. There are more than 20 unsealed manuscripts which contain complete or nearly complete texts of Matthew, among them Sinaiticus and Vaticanus, abbreviated by Aleph and B, also Codex C, D, and W, Codex Sigma. Additional ones are O to 11, L, K, M, U, V, Delta, Theta, P, and Omega. These are just some, and there are other papyri manuscripts which contain portions of Matthew, including P64 and P67, P77, P1, P45, P53, P70, and on it goes. These manuscripts are somewhat earlier than the uncial manuscripts just mentioned, though they are more fragmentary. In addition to these papyrus and uncial manuscripts, there are hundreds of minuscules which testify to the text of Matthew. Matthew is, of course, abundantly cited in patristic sources and often used in the church's lectionaries. It's translated into other early versions by the Christians in the early days. So there are a great many manuscripts available in the textual history of Matthew. As far as the canonicity of Matthew goes, it was the most popular gospel of the early church, and there was no doubt about its canonicity amongst the Orthodox in either the Eastern or Western regions of the Church. However, the heretic Marcion in the middle of the 2nd century, along with his followers, held to a canon which did not include Matthew, not to mention the Old Testament, Mark, John, the general epistles either. Marcion affirmed a sort of Gnostic dualism between the Old Testament and New Testament as revelations of two different gods. So Matthew's insistence on the fulfillment of the Old Testament by Jesus was unthinkable to Marcion. Marcion accepted only an edited version of Luke's Gospel and the Pauline Epistles as his canon. Evidently, his attack upon the early Orthodox canon was a major factor in the process which led to the formalization of the canon in the days to follow. In addition to the patristic sources already cited, the so-called anti-Marcionite prologues to Luke and John, as well as the Muratorian fragment, both speak of the undisputed fourfold gospel tradition of the Church. We can also look at Irenaeus in his book Against Heresies, 3.11.8, Cyprian, his epistle, 73.10, Clement of Alexandria, his Stromata, 3.13, and other patristic sources to confirm the canonicity of Matthew. Now, I'm sure you've had enough of this, and it's time to get into something a bit more interesting, the matter of how Matthew is put together as a piece of literature. So we now move to our third main aspect of this lecture, literary matters. Our first aspect of the literary question is, what kind of book is Matthew? What is a gospel? What do we mean by the genre of the gospels as books which have both history and theology? Due to apologetic concerns related to the need to affirm the historicity of the gospel stories about Jesus, conservative evangelicals have at times been reluctant to view the gospels as theologically motivated. This occurs in response to liberal scholarship, which tends to view the Gospels as imaginative documents produced to meet the Church's needs rather than to transmit reliable Jesus traditions. Such scholarship finds in the Gospels stories which in reality reflect situations and controversies faced by the Church after AD 70 rather than by the historical Jesus. An example of this type of thinking is the commentary by F.W. Baer in our bibliography. Evangelicals have rightly responded in defense of the historical reliability of the Gospels, such people as Craig Blomberg's work by that title, 1987. But in doing so, sometimes the theological import of the Gospels has been eclipsed. Others have argued at times from misguided dispensational views that the Gospels simply give us history and that we get theology from the New Testament epistles, especially those of Paul. However, this history versus theology dichotomy is false. The Gospels narrate what really happened, but do so for theological reasons. According to Luke's prologue, Luke did careful historical research in order to ascertain the reliability of the oral and written traditions so that Theophilus might be taught reliable truth about Jesus. If one may extrapolate from Luke's prologue to the Gospels in general, it would seem that their procedure was to transmit the Jesus traditions they had received with a view to meeting the spiritual needs of their audiences. Thus we have in the Gospels theological interpretations of selected traditions which the authors believe to be genuine historical events which occurred during the life and ministry of Jesus. This notion that the Gospels contain theologically interpreted history is particularly important when one notes the distinctive emphasis of each Gospel. The Gospel of John makes this the most clear in chapter 20, verses 30 and 31, where the evangelist states that he knew many things about Jesus which he did not write about, but that he wrote about certain things so that his audience might believe and have life. So we come to the conclusion that the Gospel authors did not write simply to satisfy the intellectual curiosity of the readers by compiling historical data. Rather, they wrote to disciple their respective communities by bringing selected episodes from the life of Jesus to bear on their respective needs. Thus, the gospel narratives teach us even today by showing us the theological and existential implications of reliable words of Jesus. Source criticism and the synoptic problem. Even a cursory reading of the Gospels reveals the fundamental similarity known as the synoptic problem. Why are the first three Gospels so similar in some respects and so different in others? While evangelicals may instinctively tend toward attributing such matters solely to the Holy Spirit's leading of the Gospel authors, reflection on Luke's prologue will take us beyond naive pietistic answers. It seems clear that Luke was aware of earlier written accounts, 1-1 of his Gospel, which in turn were based on reports circulating from early disciples and eyewitnesses. For this reason, this brief discussion of the synoptic problem is important. Theories of synoptic origins and interrelationships can be divided into two main groups, those which posit on the one hand the literary independence of each gospel, and those which posit on the other hand that there is some literary interdependence among the gospels. As far as literary independence goes, certain scholars point out the prevalence of oral transmission of sacred tradition in the ancient Near East and conclude that the phenomena of the Gospels may be explained solely by their individual editing a readily available oral tradition without any necessity of them borrowing from each other on a literary level. Such an approach may account for the differences between the synoptics with some degree of success, but it seems to falter as a satisfying explanation of the synoptic agreements, which at times involve identical wording of extended passages. Literary interdependence has seemed to have won the day, and most scholars hold to the fact that Matthew was involved in utilizing Mark when he wrote his gospel. This literary interdependence view, however, was turned on its head from the modern back to the ancient, because, as held by Augustine and many of the church fathers, they believed that the canonical order of the Gospels represented their order of literary dependence. In more recent times, the patristic approach to Matthean priority was revised somewhat in the so-called Griesbach hypothesis, which posited that Mark had used both Matthew and Luke. While some still hold to Matthean priority, the scholarly consensus today favors Markan priority, with Matthew and Luke composing their Gospels in dependence upon Mark and another hypothetical source known as Q, which purportedly contained a collection of the sayings of Jesus. Sometimes this view is known as the two-source theory, but it has been further developed into a four-source theory, in which Mark and Q are supplemented by an additional hypothetical source M for Matthew and L for Luke. As far as the position of this course goes, we are stressing a narrative approach to Matthew, not a documentary hypothesis approach, as we will now explain. Narrative criticism. The ultimate futility of arriving at anything approaching certainty in solving the synoptic problem, coupled with the atomizing tendencies of source-critical studies, have led some to adopt another approach, a literary method commonly known as narrative criticism. Narrative criticism views each gospel as a whole and draws conclusions about meaning and theology by comparing the parts of each gospel to the whole, rather than to its so-called hypothetical sources. Powell, in his book Narrative Criticism, states that in order to read the gospels like this, quote, it is necessary to know everything that the text assumes the reader knows, and to forget everything that the text does not assume the reader knows. That's on page 20 of his book. This approach seems fitting if the Gospels are viewed as theologically interpreted history written for the edification of Christian communities. One would think that the Gospels function as wholes within these communities, not as overlays to be spread upon previous Gospels or other sources. Modern scholars have been understandably preoccupied with uncovering the history of the traditions they find in the Synoptics, but such an approach seems unlikely for the ancient Christian communities. Narrative criticism seems much more appropriate than source criticism for the study of the Gospels in a church context, given the genre of the Gospels as theologically interpreted history and the canonical function of the Gospels as Holy Scripture. Therefore, this commentary will be a narrative critical study, although source critical matters will occasionally be noted. A weakness in literary criticism in general and of narrative criticism in particular is that the historical reference of the literary documents are usually ignored as being beside the point. But when Holy Scripture is studied within an evangelical context, the historical events interpreted by the literary sources must be held together. Now, finally, the literary structure of Matthew's Gospel. Grasping the structure of Matthew is crucial in the narrative critical approach, which attempts to articulate the role of the parts in framing the whole of a gospel. Although some scholars, such as Gundry and Harrington, despair of outlining Matthew, the following approaches are commonly found. Please look at the next page in your notes and compare what I'm saying with the three approaches listed there on page 4. In the Markan outline, Matthew has frequently been analyzed along the chronological and geographical lines which seem to work well in analyzing Mark. Such an approach typically yields an analysis which begins with Matthew, as in Mark, having Jesus with a public ministry in Galilee, leading him to a journey to Jerusalem with final days there, his sad betrayal, arrest, crucifixion, resurrection, and commissioning of the disciples. In these cases, we have a sort of historical biographical approach to Jesus, but it does not at all engage Matthew's distinctive pattern of alternating narrative and discourse blocks of material. A second approach to the structure of Matthew keys in on the phrase in 4:17 and 16:21, from then on Jesus began. This is the approach of Jack Kingsbury in his writings, as well as David Bauer on the structure of Matthew. They have called attention that this phrase occurs at two crucial junctures. At 4:17, just after the account of the arrest of John the Baptist, Jesus' public ministry is begun with the words, "From then on Jesus began to preach." In 16:21, just after Peter's confession that Jesus is the Messiah, Matthew says that from that point on, Jesus put his face toward Jerusalem and began to tell his disciples that he would be killed there. So it's clear that these two verses, 4:17 and 16:21, are important. Even though they are important, the question seems to be more of a biographical marker than a literary device. In other words, these are key events in the biography of Jesus, in stages of his life and ministry. But are these all that important to the structure of Matthew? I think not. I think that this is not all that different from the previous chronological geographical approach as stressed in the Gospel of Mark. And it doesn't really help us get into the matter of how Matthew alternates narrative and discourse. So this moves us on to the third position, which is the view that is taken here throughout our lectures. Students of Matthew have long noted the unique juxtapositioning of narrative and discourse material signaled by the phrase "after Jesus had finished" at the end of the major narratives. Acknowledging this Matthean structural pattern does not necessitate accepting Bacon's view that Matthew sets up five books of Jesus which answer the five books of Moses and the Pentateuch. The outline based on this unique form is found in your supplemental materials there on page 4, and a more detailed version of it is also found in later on in the supplemental materials. But you can see it in a nutshell there on page 4. It seems that this shows us clearly that Matthew was trying to tell us not simply what Jesus did, but primarily what he said. And this is the unique feature of Matthew which distinguishes it from Mark. Matthew, if you compare it with Mark on just about any given pericope or episode, you'll find that Matthew has, if anything, condensed Mark's narrative details, but has expanded the teaching of Jesus. And that is what the teaching of Jesus, then, is featured in Matthew's gospel in unique discourses, which occur, of course, in chapters 5 through 7. Notice on the outline on page 4, section 2b, the discourse on mission, section 3b, chapter 10, the discourse on the parables, 4b, chapter 13, the discourse on relationships in the kingdom, chapter 18, that's section 5b in the outline, and finally the discourse which is called the Olivet Discourse or the eschatological discourse of Jesus. After this eschatological discourse in chapter 26, verse 1, Matthew says that after Jesus had finished all these words. That may be significant in that he is calling our attention to the fact that this is the final public teaching of Jesus in the Gospel of Matthew, and all these words probably calls back to mind the previous four discourses as well as the fifth and final one in chapters 24 and 25. So please look at the outline on page 4, the bottom half of the page, based on the phrase "after Jesus finished." Look that up and pay attention to that, because it seems that that is indeed a key marker of how we need to understand the way the Gospel of Matthew fits together. This is the end of Lecture 1A. We'll see you around the corner in Lecture 1B.